Welcome back to the program. The battle between religion and secularism seems to have reached a fever pitch in the U.S. My guest today, Alain de Botton, argues that there may be a middle ground, that religions have important things to teach the secular world, that the tired old debate between atheists and believers is not helping the modern world at all, and that we need to move to more fruitful ground. For too long, he argues, we have faced a choice between either swallowing doctrines or doing away with some of the rituals and ideas of religion. He believes that religion may hold some good ideas that might help us build a sense of community, make our relationships stronger, get more out of our art and our politics, that in fact together we can build a secular commons. Alain de Botton is the co-founder of the School of Life. He's a philosopher and author. His previous best-selling books include How Proust Changed Your Life, The Art of Travel, and The Architecture of Happiness. It is my pleasure to welcome Alain de Botton back to this program to talk about Religion for Atheists, a non-believer's guide to the uses of religion. Alain de Botton, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. One of the sort of underlying ideas you talk about is this sense that religion over the years, over the decades and centuries, has been very good at marketing itself. And there are reasons for that, and that we do well, even in the non-religious world, to understand some of the marketing powers that it's had.
That's right. I mean, one way to look at religions is they have been the supreme educational vehicles. They have been brilliant at transmitting ideas. And whatever you think of the ideas, just pause to look at how effective, you know, how effectively they've been sold. And I think partly that is because religions understand that human beings are not just brains. They are bodily creatures. And if you want to try and touch someone, if you want to try and get an idea across, don't just give them a dry argument. Give them music. Give them, you know, communal meals. Give them rituals. Give them art, architecture. Take an interest in those little details, because they are also going to be the ways in which your message will get across. And I think that's something that too often the secular world has kind of missed, and it's a fascinating insight.
To what extent, though, is the other way in which religion has been able to get its ideas across fear-based? And should we take that into account as well?
Well, I mean, you know, there are so many negative sides to religion. As an atheist, I don't want to defend religion. I suppose what I've tried to say in my book is that one can, as a secular person, as an atheist, pick among the high points of religions. And, you know, this isn't something that gets some people very upset. And they say, how do you mean, you know, this is a kind of pick-and-mix approach to religion, a kind of cafeteria-style approach? And, you know, my honest answer is that is precisely what I'm doing. What I'm saying to my readers is, sure, let's look at a variety of religions, because each of them has got their high points. Each of them does something really well. You know, Buddhism is fantastic on desire. Catholicism is great on guilt. Judaism, fantastic on atonement. You know, they all have something that they're great on. And so to look at a number of religions is something that, you know, as a non-believer, we would be losing out to avoid doing.
One of the things you talk about is that what religion has been very good in finding ways to kind of curate our inner needs. Talk a little about that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. In the modern secular world, the inner needs of mankind are basically things that are seen as private. You know, like there's not too much public coordination, synchronization, organization of the inner life. You know, our big corporations deal essentially with the outer self, you know, the body and how to feed it and give it running shoes and pizzas and that kind of thing. Whereas the inner life is sort of, you know, we're left to ourselves. What religions do is they say the inner life has to be structured. That's why they all have calendars. You know, interestingly, all religions have calendars in which they try and organize significant moments around the year. They'll say, you know, in the middle of September, you've got to look at the moon. You know, if you're a Zen Buddhist, that's the time when they've got the great moon-viewing rituals and festival. You know, if you're Jewish, there's a moment where you have to atone or celebrate springtime. So there are moments in the year where you will be brought into contact with significant ideas. And the assumption there is, even if you like those ideas, if you're left to your own devices, you will forget to do this. And I think, you know, many of us can probably relate to that. You know, there's so many things that we, in theory, you know, approve of, but in practice kind of don't get around to. And religions are all about making sure that we get around to stuff because it's in the diary, it's in the calendar.
It's also a way of, to put it in more modern terms, it's a way of branding everything.
Yes, I mean, you know, religions were experts at branding long before corporations got around to this. You know, if you think of something like the Catholic Church, it was practicing branding thousands of years ago and doing so with great skill. Now, one way to think, you know, branding is just superficial, but what it's really trying to do, branding, is to say there's kind of consistency. There's consistency between, you know, this travel agency. You know, if you think Catholics had what we would now call travel agencies, where they send people on pilgrimages, and they would have the same branding as the cathedral, which would have the same branding as the library, which would have the same branding as, you know, the communal restaurant, etc. And so, in other words, there was a feeling that religions were accompanying you through all the significant moments of your life. And that's kind of quite persuasive and very interesting. And again, you know, modern intellectuals, they tend to think that religions are just a bunch of ideas, and that the way to fight religions and get on top of religions is to kind of unpick them intellectually. But I think what we're missing here is that actually religions are organizations, systems, ways of life. And to think that you can just retreat to your study and write a kind of devastatingly polemical account of religion and that religion will therefore collapse is just kind of crazy because, as I say, religions are far more than books.
The other thing that religion has been effective in doing is that it repeats its message over and over and over again in so many different ways. This is part of the branding we were talking about before, but it's based on the idea that repetition will have success after a while.
That's right. I mean, again, the secular world thinks if you tell someone something once, so long as it's intelligent and rational, that thing will stick. Religion's cleverer, I think, about human nature. Realize that however persuasive something is, you know, you tell someone something at 9 o'clock in the morning, by lunchtime they'll have, you know, pretty much forgotten it, and by evening it'll be ancient history. So you need to keep repeating lessons, and that's what religions are about, the kind of synchronized repetition of certain ideas. The secular world is all about the news, and what's new. You know, it's like what happened today for the first time is far more important than something which is maybe repeated. Whereas religions have a kind of database of wisdom that they just keep circling around and around and around. And again, that's thought-provoking, precisely because I think there's so much in our lives that we're kind of persuaded by, but it just flashes before us, and then before you know it, it's gone, and we lose some of its impact.
What about the extent, though, to which religion preaches, in many cases, a kind of rectitude, a kind of certainty, that to disagree with it creates, in fact, some of the strains we see in our society today?
Look, absolutely. You know, don't forget, look, I am an atheist and well aware of all the drawbacks. And one of the things that religion, you know, is at its weakest with is, of course, its rigidity, its intolerance. Its assertion that it knows the truth and others don't. That said, you know, intolerance and rigidity are features of human nature which do not belong in any one sphere. And I've known atheists who have been just as rigid and intolerant as believers. So, you know, this is a general human problem. But absolutely, you know, we live in a world where, you know, we're very aware of mystery, things we don't know, the limits of our minds and our reason, and any body of knowledge which says, you know, this is the truth and the absolute truth, automatically rings alarm bells. And I think religion is at its best when it admits its ignorance, and it confesses that, you know, like any other human system, it doesn't always know the answer.
One of the other areas where you talk about religion has been successful is in breaking down walls in communities, that you've seen that religion has been effective as a kind of communal host. Talk a little bit about that and how the secular world can learn from that.
Well, I think one of the things that we all accept has perhaps gone a little wrong in the modern world is community relationships. That, you know, we all know that somehow in the past things were a little better in this area, that somehow there was more neighborliness and more community. And one of the reasons, of course, is that religion has been an unbelievable glue of communities. And people who nowadays don't even believe are often drawn to religion for the sense of community. You know, they'll just love going to church or synagogue or a temple or the mosque. And really the draw is to be with others and in a kind of communal setting. I don't think religions are doing anything miraculous in relationship to this issue. They're doing something very basic, which is providing a setting in which the sociable impulses, which are in everybody, are given a chance to express themselves. Most of the time, we're scared of talking to strangers because we read the media, and the media tells us that strangers are all, you know, crazy, murderers, swindlers, you know, confidence tricksters, pedophiles. You know, so we don't talk to anyone else because we're afraid of the stranger. What religions do is they take us into a safe setting and they introduce us to the stranger, and they make it a kind of spiritual goal to get to know people who maybe we don't have that much in common with, or at least we don't think we do. And it's very different from, let's say, the modern internet-based communities, which are all about getting together with people who are a bit like you and who've got the same shared interests. You know, religions are kind of more interesting because they say, look, let's get together with some people who perhaps we don't have anything in common with superficially, but let's try and discover something. Let's try and discover the humanity beneath the stranger.
What about the role of science in helping us to navigate and understand the mystery of the world? And to what extent can that even possibly coexist with religion today?
Well, I think one of the things that science does, religion also does, is it creates a feeling of awe. And by awe, I mean a sense of how small we are before something that's very large, very old, very complex. And that feeling of awe is just as available in science as it is in religion. And I think it's a very helpful feeling because it puts us in our place. Too often in the human beehive, we get terribly busy, we get agitated, we're full of the kind of daily, you know, pressure of events, and we fall prey to envy and anxiety. And then sometimes we might look up at the night sky, and just the sight of the stars or the sight of a glacier or an ocean will just kind of quieten our inner lives a little bit. And religion seems to know this, and science sometimes seems to know this. I think it's a pity, and I say this in my book, that science too often misses out that its benefits are sometimes therapeutic and psychological. They're not just about discovering the truth. But, you know, when scientists take us in their planetariums and show us the stars, you know, maybe the point of that isn't to know every last galaxy and its technical scientific name. Maybe the point is just to come away with an overall sense of how small and, you know, ignorant and, you know, powerless we are in a gigantic universe. And so I kind of advocate an almost artistic relationship to science sometimes, looking at science not for the truth, but for the wonderful feelings that science can provoke, even without us trying to pretend that we're trying to become scientists.
You talk about the artistic aspect. In many ways, art is a critical component of much of what you talk about, both the way the religious world has used art and the way the secular world has turned art into its own kind of secular temple.
That's right. I mean, you often hear it said nowadays that, you know, museums are our new temples, our new cathedrals, and they are in the sense that so much money is poured into these places. But I think that religions have, in a way, a deeper appreciation of art in the sense that they expect far more of art. They want art to be a guide to life. They want art to remind us of what is good and scare us away from what is bad. They want art to kind of transform us. And that sounds a little bit intense. You know, if you went to an average museum and you said, you know, I want to be transformed by the collection, people would look at you a little bit strangely. So in the modern world, the secular world, we're kind of odd because we respect art, but we don't necessarily allow it to transport us and guide us in the way that religions want it to. And again, it's linked up to the idea that religions think In order to teach someone something, don't just give them a dry intellectual lesson. Touch them through their senses. And part of that is going to involve creating works of art. And, you know, there are a lot of cliches in our heads about how we should behave and how we should be. We should love people and be kind and be good and be respectful. And we kind of know this stuff, but it often doesn't come alive until we come across a really powerful work of art that kind of reminds us, like we see a fantastic movie or hear a great song or see a beautiful picture, and then we think, oh, yes, that's how I want to be. And so art has a wonderful capacity to re-energize us and motivate us. And religions know this, and that's why they use it, and they use it powerfully. And I think too often we let artists in the atheistic world just promote an agenda of shock or surprise or witty intellectual games when it's really a resource that should be changing and saving lives.
There's also the sense of ground, historical grounding. I mean, one of the things, and you mentioned this before, that modern culture tends to elevate the new, and religion has a reverence for things that are old and traditional. In some ways, the degree to which the world is moving so quickly has had a role in exacerbating this divide between religion and the secular world, in many ways for these reasons.
Yes, that's right. I mean, religions are confident that there are certain truths about human nature that don't change. You know, for the Buddhists, what the Buddha said about human nature is as true today as it was in ancient India, and it doesn't need updating. Maybe science will come along and clear up certain origins of the phenomena that Buddhism discusses. But essentially, the feeling is, look, you know, this is a valuable theory of human nature, and it lasts. And in this sense, religions are like works of art. You know, the plays of Shakespeare don't date because they're talking about things that are always true. And so you could almost say the modern world is very focused on things that are always changing, whereas a lot of literature and religion and art is focused on the unchanging stuff. And it's just worth bearing in mind how much of our own lives tends to be focused around the new. We expect that the new will be better than the old. And though that's undoubtedly true when it comes to, you know, a smartphone or a car, it's not necessarily true when it comes to a piece of psychology. And in that sense, I think religions are onto something.
And in that sense, what role can culture and traditions within those cultures that are outside of the religion, what role can they play in substituting?
Well, I mean, there was a theory out there in the 19th century, at the time when religious belief first started to dip in Western Europe, there was a feeling among many commentators that there was something that could replace religion, and that thing was, with a capital C, culture. In the famous words of the art critic Matthew Arnold, culture can replace scripture. And, you know, that's kind of a beautiful idea. The thought there is that in the plays of the great playwrights or in the great works of literature, philosophy, and art, there's enough stuff to get us a lot of the way past some of the problems that religion tackles, that there are ways to be consoled, to find morality, to find community. A lot of this stuff is in culture anyway. And the theory back in the 19th century was culture can replace scripture, and it's an idea that motivated the university builders, the humanities departments that sprung up all over the United States in the 19th century and early 20th century. There was this kind of mission on the part of culture to replace religion, and that's really kind of fallen away. I mean, it would nowadays sound so weird if you showed up at an average college in the United States and said, you know, I've come to learn how to live. I want to study culture, to be a good person, to learn how to be, you know, moral and deal with my mortality. This would just sound, well, how can we put it, really heavy. It would sound a bit over intense. And that's the thing about religions. Religions are intense. That they're in the business of saving us when we're weak and in crisis and don't know where else to turn. And I think at its worst, the modern atheistic world feels cold. It's a world in which, when you're desperate, there's nowhere particular to turn. There's no understanding that an adult can be fragile and vulnerable and have full of childlike impulses and need reassurance. And we kind of sweep a lot of that stuff under the carpet. We don't have those resources to cope with it.
In the academy, though, isn't that what role philosophy plays?
Well, I mean, if only, philosophy used to be thought of as the place that non-religious people could do a lot of the stuff that religious people do, i.e. ask big questions, mm-hmm. seek answers, seek wisdom. But nowadays, philosophy, as it's taught in universities, is a very dry technical subject that routinely disappoints swathes of undergraduates who want it to be this wonderful, tool for living. But it rarely is. There are a few philosophers, I'd include myself in the group, who are interested in writing books that discuss philosophy in that more human, kind of wisdom-orientated tradition. But we're a real minority, and the university tends to get a little bit annoyed by people like us. So I think that's a real pity and a missed opportunity.
The other thing religion uses very well, and it seems trite on some level, but it's important to people, is the use of food and drink.
Absolutely. Again, religions, remembering that we are bodily creatures, know that important lessons can be suggested to us with the help of food and drink. I mean, take something like the Zen Buddhist tea ceremony. It's a fascinating mixture of a lecture or lesson about friendship and the ritual drinking of some tea. And it's this kind of combination of social food and drink-based event and philosophy lesson, which makes it so rare and so unusual, because we're used to putting the food and the drink in one category and the ideas in another category. And religions say, no, these things belong together. And so, ever since Jesus in the Christian tradition used food and drink to make some important points at the Last Supper and at other occasions, so too other religions have done this. You find this right across the history of religion. Food and drink is part of a moral life. It's brought in to make lessons sink in and make them more palatable in the deeper sense.
In effect, the religion is, they're really like big corporations. They're just dealing with a different set of the hierarchy of needs.
That's right. Absolutely. They are organized like big corporations. After all, we call religions organized religions. And that's a feature that we might miss, that they are organized. That means they are structured like a corporation with, chief executives and a massive staff, and they're multinational, and they've got uniforms and set scripts. And, the modern world thinks a lot about individuals and how the more individualistic you are, the better you are. And we're kind of a little bit suspicious of anything that is kind of group-based. But religions remind us that being part of a group can lend you enormous power. The world is full of fantastic minds that are just sitting in their studies, in their offices, in their garden sheds, writing their stuff and getting through to a very few people. Maybe they've got a blog, or maybe they tweet occasionally, but they don't touch that many people. Whereas what religions do is they band together and they say, okay, we're now part of this group, this gigantic thing. And the only thing comparable is the large multinational corporations. And one of my suggestions in my book is to say, if you're trying to have an impact with ideas, get organized. That's what religions teach us. You're never going to get very far if you just think it's just going to be me speaking. You need to form a group. And as I say, that's something we forget.
And that's your version of atheism 2.0.
Yes. I mean, I think that, so far in the last 15 years or so, we've had a very negative kind of atheism. People like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens have been aggressive and militant and intolerant towards anything to do with religion. They've done some very good work. They've attacked various kinds of intolerance and craziness, and they've done, a very good job. But at the same time, their attacks have become a little bit sterile and intolerant in turn. And so my suggestion is we can move on. We can develop what it means to be an atheist. Being an atheist shouldn't just mean saying no to everything. It should also mean realizing that some things we need to create rather than just reject. And paradoxically, my suggestion is that at their best moments, at their wisest best moments, religions are far too complex, beautiful, and interesting to be abandoned just to those who happen to believe in them. They're for everyone, not least non-believers. And that's the kind of thrust of my argument.
Alain de Botton, the book is Religion for Atheists, A Non-Believer's Guide to the Uses of Religion. Alain, it's always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.